Welcome to the We Are Chaffee podcast, where we connect through conversations of community, humanness, and well-being in Chaffee County, Colorado. I'm Adam Williams. Today, I'm talking with Jessica Oatman. Jess is an artist, teacher, coach, surfer, among other things. She also has three teenaged kids who have homeschooled their whole lives, and from afar, it has seemed like Jess and her family are so incredibly joyful and close-knit, it's inspiring. There also has been extraordinary hardship and the need for resilience and that closeness in the family. So I talk about the full range of it with Jess. What is it that inspires vibrant joy in her art and in the way she lives her daily life? What have been the heartbreaking challenges that called for that resilience? We talk about some huge life-changing experiences in her 20s and how they led her to choose to live for the now and to focus on happiness for herself and her family and sharing that happiness with others. We talk about her growing up as the oldest of seven kids and as part of an extended military family, and about later choosing with her own family of five to get rid of the stuff and move into a camper for a life of adventure. We also get into the reality of her being an artist, spending every day having fun with her kids snowboarding, river surfing, skateboarding, traveling, and we talk about the misconceptions people often have about that unconventional family life of travel and fun and living the dream, and the assumptions that there's no way that they themselves could do it. At least not without hitting the Powerball, right? The We Are Chaffee podcast is supported by Chaffee County Public Health. Go to wearechaffeepod.com for all things We Are Chaffee podcast. That includes episode show notes and transcripts, and it's where you can subscribe to the email newsletter. Connect with us on Instagram at wearechaffeepod. And if you want to reach me, details are in the comments at the end of the episode. Now here we go, with some inspiration from Jess Oatman. Let's jump into this with my jealousy of you. From a distance, but I trust my perspective on this. You're so smiley. There's so much laughter. You and your family having so much fun. And it seems really real. And I'm just kind of curious maybe what inspires that. But also, I think you have three teenagers in the house. Is that right?
I have three, two girls and a boy. They're 19, 16 and 15.
Okay. And I just, how do you even get everybody to get along and have so much fun together?
Well, we started off like really young when they were much, infants into toddler years, just spending so much time as a family. So our main goal was to just basically have us all live outside, adventuring, exploring what was around us and just making sure that they grew up, that they knew that, that their sibling was what's going to be there for them all the time. So just instilling that happiness and laughter of being outdoors with all of our kids and as a family was super important. So now they all they get along. We all go ski. We all go raft. We do all the things together for the most part. And people will ask us, like, how is it that your kids get along? And really, that's why. Like, we really just instilled that, togetherness from an early on stage.
I would like to say that I think we tried the same and it did not go as well. We even had a little book when my two boys were really young called Brothers Forever. You read it at bedtime, you read it whenever. Yeah. And I've tried to instill in them your brother is who is always there.
Yeah.
Like for everything. And yeah, it just hasn't taken the same way. So that's why I playfully say, there's a healthy jealousy, that there's just so much joy, it seems like, in your family. And I think it's amazing.
Yeah. No, and like there's certain things that we like don't allow in our family. Like we have like a no closed door kind of policy. Like we don't allow them to go to their room and just close their door and spend time by themselves. Like either we're a family. We live in a small home. It's like only 850 square feet. We also sold all of our stuff back in 2014 and hit the road in a camper. So we had a 34 foot class A, and then moved into a 13 foot vintage camper. So we've always been around one another and they just have done well with it. And so have we, I can't spend that much time with my kids, but really, that's, you had kids, right? So you want to enjoy them and it's better to include them in things. Whereas a lot of people would say they're too young to go hiking or they're too young to take to Disney World or they're too young. But if you start from a young age, then they don't know any different and they just grow up that way. So they've done well sleeping on the road and camping and doing all the things like that.
A 13-foot camper almost sounds like you can't even measure the square feet for, you know, a no. family of five to live in it.
Yeah.
And I want to get into some of that in a bit. But if we come back to, I'd ask kind of along the way here, what inspires the joy? And for you, is this somebody you've always been? Have you always just been somebody who's happy, who's, I don't know, present in whatever adventure you're having? Or, you know, what really inspires that as you're leading your family along the same path?
There's been a couple different things that have probably changed my perspective on life. I mean, I've always been kind of an outgoing and happy person, but, well, our son was diagnosed with cancer back in 2007. And so he ended up getting leukemia. And so seeing him battle through that also changed my perspective. And then my brother was killed in Afghanistan in 2009. And so at that point on, that's when I think as a family with my husband and I kind of decided to change our path and the way things were, because, you know, everyone's like, oh, the American dream, you got to have this job and a 401k and all this stuff. And we decided to just take the chance and the risk, knowing that my brother died. And so he never got what was going to come like forward in the future for him. And then with my son, seeing a lot of his friends who passed away from brain cancers and stuff, it really just kind of opened our eyes. And we were like, you know what? Let's just throw it all to the wind and we're going to just hit the road and go see what is out there. And so you choose to live for, you know, today is how we are now, kind of. So bringing happiness, sharing that with others, and just not having like a negative view on life, even though a lot of negative has come our way.
How old was your son? Because he was very young, right? I think that's worth bringing up.
Yeah. He was 2.5. He was 2.5 years old when he was diagnosed. And he had acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And so he was diagnosed and we had to go to Memphis, Tennessee, to St. Jude is where we went with him. And then he battled for till he was five years old is when he took his last dose of chemo. And so then he's listed like cured at 10 years old. So now he's 19. And so from all that time forward, we'd go every year back to Memphis and do checkups and make sure he was still in remission and all that kind of stuff.
That's such a young age. And as parents, I mean, you must have been, were you in your 20s?
I was 27 when he was diagnosed. So we were only 26 and 27 years old when we had our son fighting cancer. And, you know, people are like, oh, well, how did you make it through that? And really, I mean, you don't have a choice, right? You're just thrown into this. And I was coaching swimming at the time and had just gone to Columbia to go coach this big meet. I was the head age group coach for Missouri State at the time. And I got the phone call from the doctors. It was like, hey, you need to take your son and you need to be to Memphis tonight. I remember being like in Tennessee, like Memphis, Tennessee, because we were living in Springfield, Missouri. And he's like, yes. So I drove 3 hours back home. We meet at a McDonald's with my in-laws, pick up my son, and we drive and we show up to like St. Jude at like 2 o'clock in the morning. And the hospital's like quiet and like right then, you know, it's a whirlwind. You don't know what's going on, what's going to happen. And from then, it was just our whole life changed.
Why was it so urgent that that drive needed to happen right then?
At the time, they were surprised that he was even walking. Like he was so what happened initially was I went to go visit my family in Virginia and my son was just crying all the time, sleeping all the time. And I was like, what in the heck is going on with him? We went to the beach. He just wanted to lay in the sand. He wouldn't do anything. And so I tried taking him to the doctor and I took him 3 times. And it wasn't until I went back to Springfield, Missouri that the doctor there was like, we need to run blood work. And so that's the doctor then. I was like, okay, well, I have a swim meet. Let me know. And so he called me and he's like, this is urgent. He's basically, it was on the verge of, I mean, he could die really at any time. So he needed to like have chemo and all the stuff done right away.
Did you have any other kids at the time?
I
don't remember the age gap that you described. So
yeah. So believe it or not, the week prior, I found out I was pregnant with my second. So now I'm pregnant and now I'm fighting cancer with my son. And it was hard at the time. I wasn't allowed to like change his diapers because his chemo was so strong. So my husband would have to do that stuff because I couldn't let it like go into my skin because I'm pregnant. And I couldn't go back for some of the procedures and stuff because I was pregnant. So things like that were kind of difficult. And then I have my daughter. And so I had to have 3 C-sections. And so I have my daughter. So my husband flies home because my son's now going through a high like dose treatment. And so he flies home with me. We have this, and, you know, our baby. And then he's like, okay, I got to go. So now it's just me and my daughter. I just had a C-section. He flies back to Memphis to go spend, you know, this like intensive treatment with him. Yeah, I mean, it's a whirlwind to look back on and think, holy cow, how do we do this?
It does sound like an awful lot. And, you know, these big experiences, I think, in a marriage, in a partnership, whatever kind of relationship, did you find with your husband that that helped draw you closer? Was that something that strengthened things?
Yeah.
Or did the strain kind of, I mean, how did that feel to you at the time, do you think?
I mean, to be quite honest, actually, St. Jude has like a lot of different resources and stuff. I mean, we didn't use it per se, but they were always worried about divorce because when you have a kid with cancer, the divorce rate like skyrockets. But no, we never, I think we just have done it really well together. He would take care of one thing, I would take care of the next, and we just still managed to somehow make things work, you know, together. Because then after that, it was in 2009, so Montana's still going through cancer treatment. I have a 6-month-old baby, and then I am pregnant with my third. So I find out when McKenna is 5 months old that now I'm pregnant again, okay? And then my brother died. So now I have my son going through cancer treatment, a 6-month-old at the time, and then my brother died. But my youngest daughter was born 9 days after my brother died. So we just had this whole time, you know, and you think, oh, Lord, please just like don't. Hopefully it's smooth sailing like from this point on, because right in the early stages of our marriage was just so much was just thrown at us. So a lot of that really shaped who I have become, I think.
There's so much emotion going on. Both of those times you just described, you find out you're pregnant. Mm-hmm. Within a matter of days, you find out what to me as a parent would be some of the worst news I could possibly learn, right?
Yeah.
Is your son has cancer. This is extremely serious. And then the loss of your brother and that is so much. And this is all before you hit 30.
Yes.
You're the oldest of 7 kids. Mm-hmm. Where was your brother in that lineup of age, and how close were you with him as kids, if not young adults?
Yeah. So I was the oldest of 7 and my brother was the 4th. So we like to give my mom a hard time because she had like almost like 2 separate families, it feels like. So she had the first 4 of us. She had 4 by the time she was 24. So we were all super close, the 4 of us. So it was 3 girls and a boy. So Paul was the youngest of the 4 of us at the time. Then she had an 8-year gap and had my twin brothers, and then another 8-year gap and had my youngest brother, Adam. So I'm in college swimming and she's like, hey, by the way, you're going to have another brother. And I'm like, what? You know? But anyway, so there were 7 of us. So Paul was the 4th. So he literally fell like in the middle. And him and I were super close. We were very close. He was my like adventure buddy. I mean, if there was something bad that happened, it was usually him and I that were involved in it somehow. It's like my dad saying, like, don't take your brother and put him on your handlebars and go riding. You know, what did we do? We sure did. And we go over the speed bumps and he flies off and scratches. And he's like, what did I tell you? You know, so we just did so many like fun things together. And we always planned on coming out to Colorado to come adventure here and do all the fun stuff like that. But yeah, he was definitely my outdoor friend.
Was he in the Army?
Yes. Okay. So he was in the Army. He was stationed at Fort Eustis. So my dad was stationed at Fort Eustis as well. And him and my dad were super close as well. But he was a lightweight vehicle mechanic in the military and had gotten deployed to Kuwait and Iraq and then Afghanistan. So it was August 19th when, I was super fortunate because I lived in Missouri. And then Chris and I decided to move back to Virginia. So we moved back to Virginia and Paul happened to be coming home for his R&R at that time. So I got to see him. He was like on a 2-week break. We did all the things. I was pregnant with Mila, my youngest at the time. And we went to the beach and I got to take family like photos for them and stuff for him and his wife. They had only been married for 1 year when he was killed. And so at the time, before then, I flew home. I did engagement photos for him. And in his photo, he just happened to be wearing the shirt that says Live in the Dream. And so when he was killed, that photo was plastered like all over the news. And I mean, nationwide, like his picture was everywhere. So that's when I just decided like that I would live this life for him. Like he never got to, now he died at 23 years old. and we didn't get to do the things that we had planned on doing and stuff like that. So I was like, you know, I can either turn this into a super negative experience, which it was, but going forward, I decided I wanted to live for joy for him. So everything I do now is living the dream.
Even though I was in the Army myself, and of course have known people who, you know, we've lost, I can't imagine being in the family and, you know, you've got 7 kids or parents, however all far this ripples out, yeah, and getting that call. Yeah. It's again, the worst fear, right? Mm-hmm. Is he's there ostensibly for positive reasons, you know, that you mm-hmm. all believe in. You mentioned your dad also being yeah. in the Army. So, you know, we have a military family,
and 100%.
This is something that you all knew was a possibility.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, when it happens,
we get that, believe it or not, people made that comment a lot in a negative like connotation, like, well, you knew this was a possibility, you know? And it's like, well, yeah, when you get in a car, you could die, you know, that's a possibility, you know? I mean, you don't know when death is going to be knocking at your door. You hope that it's not today, you know, but yeah, you're right. It could happen. And for my brother, he wasn't killed like by like an EOD. It was like not a firefight or anything along those lines. So for him, it was actually just an accident. He was super kind. He'd give you the shirt off his back. He was so like helpful, and he was really good at his job. He wanted to come back, and he actually planned on getting out and opening up his own like car mechanic shop kind of thing. So it was a Monday. He went to work on a Monday and was killed on Wednesday. So he'd only been back to Afghanistan for 3 days basically before he died. And somebody was having problems working on a vehicle, and it was a forklift, and they had hoisted it up in the air. And so he's like, oh, I'll do it for you. Like, it's fine. Get out of the way. I'll show you how it's done. And the chains happened to snap, and they didn't put the safety. So whoever had it done did it wrong. Paul didn't know this. And so he was basically crushed is what happened. And so it was that Wednesday. I mean, I sat down to have a bowl of cereal, and that's when my sister called and was like, hey, Paul was killed. And so we all went over to my parents' house, and it's like just a day you don't want to relive, you know, and it is like the movies. My dad saw the van drive down the street. I mean, my dad has been in the military for many, many years and works with a lot of special forces and stuff. So he's very well aware, and he kind of already had an inkling then when he saw this van drive by. So he knew, but you know, it's like a day you don't want to relive that. I'll never forget calling. We had to call my sister-in-law and had to lie to her basically, because she was down in Virginia Beach, and you don't want to tell her while she's down there, like, hey, your husband was killed. So we told her we like wanted to have like this get together kind of thing. And she knew too, by the time she drove up and saw all of our cars there and everything, it was like, it's probably one of the worst sounds you could imagine is to hear her screaming from outside. But
yeah. Yeah. In military families, this is, it's a unique experience. And I think, you know, like you said, sometimes people, there's a lack of empathy and understanding to say, yeah, but he's in the military. Yeah, he's in war. Yeah. Aren't you?
Yeah.
Doesn't that somehow remove the heart from it?
Oh, you should. I mean, some people had even told my mom, like, well, at least you have 6 others.
Oof.
Like, what the heck? You know, we aren't goldfish. You know what I mean? There's... Like, how do you say that, you know, to somebody that... Each person is an individual and, you know, different personalities, and it's still your child. So here's my parents who just lost their son, and then here I am in the hospital giving birth to their grandchild. So it was a huge mix of emotions of, you know, like you have your, and I like to think that maybe because my youngest, we named her Myla Paul, and she has a unique connection to him, even though she never got to meet him. She does a lot for him, likes to wear the bracelets with his name and, you know, different things like that. So it's like, I really wonder, you know, did they get to meet somehow before she came into this world while he was leaving? So definitely, definitely a tough time for my whole family at that point.
So this military family that you grew up in, you moved, lived in some different places. I understand you lived in Germany a total of 10 years back and forth. And that your mother is even German.
Yeah.
So clearly then, I assume, your father met her when he was at some point stationed in Germany. Was your family similar to the one you've now created with your husband and your kids in terms of this joy and outdoor togetherness and all of the thing? Did you kind of grow up with that being the model?
Yeah, for the most part, I think I did. I grew up, a very good life. I mean, a military, brat. But my mom is really the adventure person. My dad grew up the youngest of eight, very poor, never had a car, lived on the third floor, like apartment, no college. None of his siblings did college or anything like that. So he joined the military to get out of that situation. That was like up in Lewiston, Maine is where he grew up. Whereas my mom grew up also military. So my grandma's full German. And I have family that live over in Germany still. So she met her husband when he was stationed there. And then my mom worked for my dad, my grandpa, and met my dad that way. So he also worked for my grandpa. So that's kind of how they met. But my mom was the adventure one. She grew up outside, traveling all over Europe, hiking and playing in the snow, and has just always had that like wanderlust spirit of wanting to get out there and do things. So I knew growing up that, which is where swimming comes into play and the beach and all that stuff, that no matter what, you got up, you put on a swimsuit because we were either going to the beach, to the pool, to the river. It didn't matter what we were doing. I grew up around the water. And she just has instilled that within our family and all of our kids. So that I attached to that. Whereas like my one sister did not. She's not an outdoor person at all. She has no desire to hike, bike, do none of it. She's the shopper. So that I didn't take from any of that. That's not me. And so, yeah, the joy has always kind of been there in that way.
You ended up swimming on scholarship at Missouri State University, but I wonder if you ever considered enlisting in the Army yourself, or if you would have had swimming not been a different kind of path for you.
Yeah, I was not ever going to probably join the Army. I did debate actually swimming for the Air Force. So that was one option that I had thought about. And I did have a friend that I swam with in Virginia who actually ended up doing that. But I really liked what Missouri State had to offer me. My dad was stationed here in Colorado Springs at the time. So I'd moved from Virginia my junior year of high school, went to school at Liberty High School in Colorado Springs, started swimming there. And then that's when like letters started coming in my junior year for scholarship money. And Missouri State was starting a brand new women's Division I program. And they were offering me pretty close to a full ride. So I was like, okay, well, I'll move to the middle of the country, even though I really wanted the beach. But yeah, so that's where I ended up.
You didn't think about going into the Army for yourself. And I'm kind of curious, what goes into that kind of decision? Obviously, you're your own individual. All your siblings are as well. But you've already named so many people, referred to so many people in your family that the military life really is through and through.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of curious what maybe the coaching from your parents might be. You know, what did they want for you? How do you decide, that's been great being part of this growing up, but that's not my life?
I don't know. I just don't think that I didn't want to be in the Army for sure. Just being a female, hearing different stories and stuff. I just didn't feel like it was the right fit for me. Like I didn't want to do that. My brother joined the Army. My husband went in after my brother was killed. So that was kind of
Wow. That was after you were already together and had three kids.
Yes.
And he went into the Army.
Yes. He celebrated his 30th birthday at boot camp. Yep. So that was a little bit more emotional. Emotionally hard for me because now I'm like, well, what if my husband dies? You know, my brother was just killed. My husband's going in. My dad was still in the Army. My sister had been in the Air Force. Her husband's in the Navy or was in the Navy. So yeah, we have a huge military, like a lot of the branches are covered except for the Marines actually. But it was not something that I wanted to do. I knew if I was going to go into any branch, it was probably going to be the Air Force. But yeah, it just wasn't going to be a fit for me.
Was that a tough conversation with your husband when he decided after you've already lost your brother and you've already got three kids and he's turning 30.
Yeah.
I mean, this obviously he still is young enough to go in, you know, by the rules, he still is accepted in all these things. But at that point, you also could say, life has already kind of taken its course.
Yeah.
Maybe this isn't the way I choose.
Yeah. We knew the benefits of being in the military and it was something that we probably needed at the time. It was like we needed a way out. Financially, things were tough. And, you know, bills are piling up kind of situation. He wanted to join to honor my brother in a way also. And he was just looking for something different for himself. And it ended up being a really good experience for us. He ended up being, he worked on tugboats in the military, which is a very small branch.
Yeah.
So you can't even really be stationed anywhere besides Fort Eustis, Virginia, Korea, and Hawaii. And I was like, well, if we go to Hawaii, I'm totally down for that. But we didn't end up going. He was in for 4 years and he was medically discharged. And we stayed right there. So it was like where we lived, he stayed. So I never had to move. I was still around my family. I still got to heal and be around with the grief of my brother. We did so much fundraising. I got to be involved with that with my dad. We raised $10,000 for a soccer field that was in that stall called like Dumont Field. It's in Williamsburg, Virginia. So we did that. We've done all kinds of runs. We've been, he's buried at Arlington National Cemetery. So I got to go there all the time while you're there. So it ended up working out for us in the best way possible. Montana was still going through treatment and the St. Jude would fly us out there to see them. But he'd go to CHKD, which is in Virginia Beach. So we went to CHKD. So there's just a lot going on.
What does that stand for?
Children's Hospital's King Daughter.
Okay. That is incredibly rare to go into the military, stay right at home.
Yes.
Do all of your time there.
Yeah.
It sounds like, because was he in for 4 years?
Yeah, 4 years. Yep.
So after he got out, then that's getting close to the time when you all would sell everything and jump into an RV and
it was
hit
at
the road.
That point in time, I think. It'd now been a couple years after Paul died. Montana finished his treatment and we were like, it's now or never. Like the kids are still young. When we decided to leave, I think they were 3, 4, and 7. And we were like, okay, let's do it. Let's sell everything. So we had huge, huge yard sales, threw stuff away, donated stuff. Yeah. It was kind of super freeing to get rid of all of your junk, you know, like didn't need anything. And I was just so ready for a new adventure to just kind of, let's go do this.
Had you been sitting in kind of that experience that we're talking about 5 years since your brother's death, mm-hmm. you're with family, there is that grief, there is, you know, all of this with your life going on, your kids, your husband going into the army, all of this sort of stuff. Maybe if I'm not reaching too far here, mm-hmm. was it time for just, I need a new chapter, something that's totally fresh.
Yes.
Let's get a new start.
Yeah, because it's so easy to just get complacent with where you are and what you're doing on the everyday cycle of things. And I take after my mom in that way where I don't need things. I want experiences. And I have always liked to adventure and be more wild and free. And Chris was he's the same way. But he grew up.
That's your husband?
Yeah, so Chris is my husband. And he was born and raised in Springfield, Missouri. So never moved, hardly didn't do anything, just stayed right there. But I moved every 3 years of my whole life. So it was kind of like, I'm ready to go again. I'm not used to it. So that's why I have to laugh, because this is the longest I've ever lived anywhere is right here in BB. And I'm like, really BB? Like, it's such a small little community. But anyways, we can get into that later. So yes, it was like, 2014, we decided to just hit the road with our kids and didn't know where we were going. I knew we were going to Florida first. So that's where we went. I have always just wanted to go live by the beach and I've wanted to surf and live by the ocean and raise my kids there. So we did that. Chris worked at Ron John Surf Shop down there and it was an amazing winter. Kids were in swimsuits all the time. You know, it's winter, it's December, you have palm trees instead of Christmas trees, you know, it's like it was just super great. And then Chris's dream though and his passion was whitewater kayaking. So when I met him in Missouri, he always wanted to come to Colorado. And I was like, dude, no, I don't want to go to Colorado. Like, I just left there, you know. But I lived in Colorado Springs, and it's just such a difference from Colorado Springs to living in the mountains, per se.
Yeah.
So he got a job at a rafting place here at AAE and raised our kids there. We were the first family to ever live on property. Mike at the time was running it. And he's like, Jess, we've never had anybody bring their kids to come live at a rafting place. And I'm like, well, here we are. They get to meet all these, you know, bums, and we'll see how it goes, you know. But it worked out great that they invited us back. So we left there, went back to Florida, lived in Florida again for a while. And then that next summer came back out to AE for the second season. So at that point, we had to like kind of make a decision. Like, what do we want to do now? Like, where are we going to go? And ended up, we had a friend who was renting a place here in town that wanted out, and we moved in and we've never left. So we've been here now for almost 9 years.
How long were you living in the RV and camper in total?
Probably 3 years. We probably did it for 3 years.
And so it sounds like it wasn't meant to be a van life kind of thing where you're trying to, you know, tour all 50 states or whatever like that. It was just simply a a different way of living, a smaller lifestyle, outside oriented lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, did I want to travel to all 50 states and live in a camper full time? Yes. But then you have to deal with the jobs and the money. And we weren't, I mean, we're not like software engineers or anything. We're not, we don't have computer jobs. So getting income to continue to continuously move in that way was always really difficult. So it's like we had to job hop is what we did. So like we'd work at Ron John seasonally and we'd come here and work here seasonally. So everything was a seasonal like job. So it didn't allow us that possibility to just continuously move around.
I think that brings up a really interesting point for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. When they look at, let's say somebody who's following you on social media or something, and they're like, oh, she has this amazing life. Somehow these kids aren't in school and they're having this amazing life. They're always, you know, they're snowboarding, they're surfing, they're, you know, whatever, skateboarding. And I think people tend to get curious then and say, well, I can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, I can't afford my bills and do that. So they must be trust fund kids or whatever, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you're bringing up, I think, what is a really common point of curiosity for people and maybe their envy sometimes, where they're like, how do you get to live this cool life that's romantic and sexy and so much fun? Because I could never. But really what we're talking about is you and Chris made decisions. You made choices. And I mean, tell me more about that. What has that taken for you to live this dream?
Yeah.
And not be bound to say what so many of us are, is this conventional 8 to 5, I have to have insurance, I have to have a mortgage, I have to have roots.
Right. The roots factor was not ever important to me. I don't feel like I needed to set down any kind of roots. So it's been easy to be like, okay, let's just go. Let's just go see what else is out there. And I love meeting people and making new friendships and having those experiences. As far as the money aspect of things, well, I don't come from a rich family. There is no trust fund over here, or my parents give me allowance every week or anything like that. So we knew that we had to job hop to make that happen. We homeschool our kids and they've never been in a school setting.
Did you intend that from the beginning of life? Let's say when you and Chris decided, hey, we want to have kids, this is how we want to raise our family, they're always going to be homeschooled.
No.
Or was that a decision? Because they were getting towards school age.
Yes.
You said 3, 4, and 7 years old when you hit the road. That's getting into school.
Yeah.
And so that is kind of a critical point where a lot of people would say, oh, we missed our chance because now they have to go into school.
Yes, yes. Well, and now there's just, I mean, there was too, you know, back in the day, I guess, but there's just so many more opportunities now for education and different ways to teach them. But the reason we ended up homeschooling and starting that was because when Montana was going through cancer treatment, it was kindergarten age. And because of his immune system, we decided not to put him into school. So we kept him home. And I was like, you know, we'll homeschool. Well, my mom at the time was also homeschooling my twin brothers and my youngest brother. So my youngest brother is only 3 years older than my son. So they kind of grew up together and got to homeschool and go to co-ops and things like that when we were living in Virginia. So that's why we ended up keeping him home. And then when the girls came around, homeschooling was working for us. And I was like, okay, we'll just homeschool all of them. And then while Montana, like I said, St. Jude offers so many different resources, that's when they tested him and found out he's dyslexic. So it was just a better fit for us to keep him home, work with him, get things, you know, situated educational wise. And then when we hit the road, it just made it that much easier. So it's like, okay, well, this works for us. Now we can school anywhere. You go to national parks, they have junior ranger programs. And I mean, there's just so many opportunities out there. So we took advantage of all that kind of stuff. And then, now being here and then living this kind of life, it all just kind of encompassed everything and has worked out for us.
I'm curious what you used as sort of the method, if for lack of a better word, for how you homeschooled, if you followed a structure or not. And here's where I'm coming from with this question, was during COVID that I was with our two sons for 2+ years with something called unschooling, which is unstructured. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, kid or student led. What are your interests? And the idea with that philosophy is that you're going to learn math or science along the way with your other interest and so on. So it wasn't a super structured curriculum handed down to me by the state.
Right. We are 100% unschoolers.
I love that. Yes. I think it's such an incredible way to go. Now, I will say, you know, our kids are back in the school system. They made that decision. The younger one, I think for social reasons, decided he needed to have more connection. And he had more struggle with self-motivation for how he wouldn't say, oh, this is my passion, let me dive into it.
Yeah.
Whereas my older son had a passion with computers and using computers for all kinds of things. He built his computer at age 9 or 10. I mean, he loved this stuff. And so he dove into it, and I knew he could be content all day long.
Yeah.
How have you found that to be with your kids and how they can, now, they're really well along the way in their schooling, yeah, and certainly your son at 19 is.
Right, right. People would always say, like, well, I just don't know if I could homeschool my kids. I don't know if I know what I'm doing. And really, you learn along the way with them at the same time. So, I mean, we're always learning. And that's what I tell my kids. Like, even I'm still learning. There's things that I learn every day, or, you know, if I'm interested in it, I'll go and research it. And so just sharing that and passing that down to them on how to research. So as long as your kids can read, then they're capable of learning absolutely anything. Then that's on, you know, it's on them, as especially in high school age. So like my son, he's now at like working at camps. He's at Kanakuk. And I mean, the comment we get all the time is your kids are super polite, respectful. They can hold a conversation with an adult. And it's like, that's, and I feel I can say that's because they have been around an array of different aged people. So when you homeschool or unschool, either way you look at it, they're with little kids learning to babysit or teach these, you know, the younger kids how to read or to do math. But then at the same time, they're with my friends, or they're learning like from, you know, at the rafting place. So there's, if you can school them that way at home, then there's an array of possibilities for them to get an education from absolutely anything. So they learn business, you know, if they're going to hang out with, like me, doing my art business, they helped me run that at times. Or McKenna did an internship with the Mount Princeton Riding Stables. I'm doing trail rides, and my son is at the camps. And I mean, so it's life. They're living life. They're just starting it at a younger age. That's all.
I think that's such a great way to put it, is they're living life. And through life and living that, we learn.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%. And I think so many of us, when we're in the system and you're following rules, and well, this is how you have to solve that math problem, this is how you have to do these things. I think a lot of, you know, after a lot of years of that, you forget how to think for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
I grew up with parents as teachers, and I was a sophomore in college, and it was a friend who finally got the light to click on for me. Think for yourself.
Yeah.
So when I was preparing for a test, it wasn't just rote memorization. He's like, think in terms of concepts.
Mm-hmm.
Actually think about the stuff. You're not just trying to regurgitate and get through the hoops so you get your degree so you move on with your life.
Right.
And I don't think that really should have taken a peer who was 19 or 20 years old to be the one to, you know, because I'd already had so many teachers. And like I said, my parents were teachers.
Right, right.
So I love, like, you know, for your kids in particular, they've never been in that system.
No.
So instead, what they've learned is how to think for themselves, how to problem solve.
Yes.
And with all the way you've talked about how this comes together, various jobs, you know, work ethic, but also you're not averse to risk. And like, you're just instilling in them so many different values that I think sets them up for so much more in life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's allowed them actually. So the girls also coach gymnastics at Arc Valley. So it's allowed them to have these jobs and start a job even younger. Or Mila, who's into art, she wants to start her own art business. So we've been like pursuing that, and she loves to make cupcakes, and there's just, they can start these. They're going to learn because they're starting businesses at a younger age, even. They have the possibility. Not that you can't do that in school, but in school, then it's like all the studying and the testing and the, you know, but in reality, you know, I don't feel like they necessarily need to have that to be successful in life. I mean, you can learn so much stuff just from YouTube. I mean, like I said, it's changed over the years, and the education is beyond anything you can comprehend as far as like what your kids are going to eventually get to know, what they want to know. I mean, it's there at their fingertips. And so I tell them, like, well, go research it. Don't come to me to give you the answer. Instead, go online, go look it up, you know, see what there is that you want to do. Then come to me if you have questions.
Yeah. You are an artist, as you've mentioned. Your art is so colorful and vibrant, and there's a lot of joy in that as well. Was that a change at all with this mentality, you know, going through the experiences we've already talked about?
Mm-hmm.
When you took this life perspective, live for now, live with joy, and like tomorrow's not granted.
Right.
Did your art change at that time? Is that when you went into this particularly vibrant style?
Actually, no. I mean, really, I have always painted in color. Like, everything is always bright and vibrant. And I've always like, I think I was in high school. I used to collect the sun, like sun, anything with a sun on it. I wanted, it's orange. Orange is my favorite color, orange, yellow, and pink. You know, it just radiates happiness, and those colors can change people's moods. And so I just have always had that. Now, I will say I never expected to be painting waves in the middle of a mountain. Like living in the mountains and painting surf art, that's something that's beyond me. I'm still like super thankful, love to do it. So I thought I'd have to be by the beach to do that. And here I am getting to do it in BB.
You grew up with some time in Virginia, some coast time, Florida, surfing, we're talking ocean surfing. Now you're out here with the river. River surfing is a thing. I mean, I think I'm not maybe super versed in this, but I do think that the Arctic Valley is a hub for river surfing. I think, especially with Mike Harvey here, who I've talked with on the podcast as well. And, and the Scout Wave down there, which I know you crush on. And so did you start river surfing here? Was this the first place that you got into it?
Oh yeah, for sure. I had never river surfed anywhere else. So what happened was, when Chris wanted to move out here to kayak, I was really worried, like, well, then I don't get to surf anymore. You know, like I'm going to be in the mountains and that's going to kind of suck. So I tried to find a way for me to get involved in the river. And so I started to sup. I tried kayaking, just wasn't my thing.
Stand up paddleboard on the river?
Yeah. So like downriver. It's like, so I bought my first like bad fish board back in Virginia, had it shipped out there. And then we ended up coming out here in 2013, just on a vacation, like a trip. And I took a lesson through RMOC. I was like, okay, I could do this. Like, this could be doable. So then when we moved here, that's what I started on. Then I surfed for the very first time here at Staircase in BB. And it was on a sup, like a board, like a long board, my Badfish, like MVP 9-foot board, huge thing. And I had a paddle. And I just remember thinking, if I could just get rid of this paddle, like, you know, I just want to surf. Like, I just wanted to surf so bad. And while it replicated, it just didn't feel like the same to me. And then, so I just surfed Staircase for years. And then Scout Wave was built two years ago now. And it took me a little bit to get involved in it because I didn't have the right board for it. And then somebody was like, Jess, you need to like come and try this. They let me use their board and that was it. Now I'm like, okay, now I never need to move. Now I can surf like all the time and I don't have to worry about getting eaten by a shark or anything like that.
They are different hydraulics, and something about the technique, I imagine, is different. I have yet to get into it. I've talked about that on the podcast that I have one of the inflatable river surfers from Badfish, and I've talked with Mike. He's going to go out with me and help get me started because I haven't leaped into it yet.
Right,
I got some of the gear off of one of the rental outfits, know, cheap, and so I can be set up to go and I still haven't done it. So this summer, I need to get with those of you who are into this and can give me the courage and the techniques to get going. But I wonder about what the difference is when you have this experience with ocean surfing and you get on the river. Do you go back and forth some? Like, do you still get out to ocean and you're like, oh wait, I got to remember, how does it work here?
Yeah. It's different as far as like obviously getting on the wave, popping up. Because in the river, the water is coming to you, and in the ocean, you're going with it, you know? So that aspect is different. And also, I feel like, ocean surfing is, you got the salt water, the salty air, you know, like it's just different in that way. And then you sit out there and you wait for these waves. Whereas here, it's always, the wave is consistent, but now you're waiting in a lineup, you know? And so getting to meet people though is what changes the river surfing here too, because now while you're waiting, you're probably joking around, hanging out with people, talking about your day-to-day life or whatever. Whereas in the ocean, it's a lot different. That unless you go out with somebody, then you can sit there and talk to them off and on. But that aspect is probably different too. Plus the river is, you know, it's pretty dang cold.
You know, the vibe of the community, especially at the Scout Wave, is so amazing to me, just so far as a spectator.
Yeah.
That whenever I'm in Salida and it's, you know, the waves up and people are out there, it's that season, I want to go over and hang out and just be around the people, even though I'm outside of the circle, it feels like.
Right. Yeah. No, it's been super great. I've met so many amazing people down there, created so many good friendships from it. Everyone has the same passion as surfing. And then you just get to know them and then get to know their life. And then now you start to hang out outside of it. So now we've like gotten a group to skateboard, or now we go up to the mountain and snowboard. And it's just been, yeah, it's been great to be down there and to get to know the community more, especially when it comes to the surfing aspect.
You also snowboard, right?
Yeah.
So all things board?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we got, you know, surfing down mountains, surfing on rivers, surfing in oceans, yeah. Surfing in a skate park.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of funny because I was like 16 and I always wanted to learn to snowboard and I didn't get to grow up doing any of that. So my parents could never afford anything like that. And so moving out here, so when we did move out here and decided to stay, Chris got a job at Monarch. And so he eventually was running the lift department for a couple years. And because of that, because Monarch has such an amazing program for family, like we all got to get a season pass. And so that's the only reason we could afford to get into it then. So all of us, I was like, heck yes, I finally like get to learn to snowboard. So you get like, you can get a free lesson, you get these season passes, we could put our kids on the ski team or the programs. And so then we just piecemealed all of our equipment to get to where we're at. So it was like, okay, well, maybe this time we can get new gloves or, you know, a helmet. And it wasn't like we could just go out and then go, oh, we decided to snowboard, so we're going to go buy all this stuff, you know. That definitely was not how it was for us. But so yeah, I asked him, it was like for my birthday one year, I was like, will you please take this lesson? Like, do this with me. And he's like, oh, because he kind of got, his dad used to teach skiing from Missouri State, which is so funny. And they'd come out here and go to Colorado with his like school program. So Chris got to learn to ski from a young age. And then his dad did his master's like up in Bozeman. So he's been like to Big Sky and all these places where I didn't grow up like that at all. So anyway, so he took this lesson with me for snowboard for my birthday and he's never skied again.
Yeah, once I made the switch and I started snowboarding, I pretty much don't touch skis at this point.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, I was always envious of the boots.
Well, that's like,
they
his
just
thing.
Look a lot more comfortable.
Yeah.
And they are.
Yeah. Yeah. He actually was medically discharged from the military because he has bad feet. Mm. So ski boots really killed him. So snowboarding boots ended up working out. And at the time we were in Virginia, we both got into longboarding, like downhill longboarding. And so it just, he had some of the board sport stuff going on. And then I fell in love with it anyway, regardless. But I was like, okay, so snowboard, here we are, skateboard, you know, surf.
What's the typical day look like for you? We've talked about art, your homeschooling kids, tons of fun out here in the mountains, living life, living the dream. What's the typical day for you?
I usually wake up early. So I'll
dark probably,
early. Yeah. Like, yeah. Dark early, like 4 o'clock early. So I can like paint and get things done. I usually try and paint for about 4 hours, 4 to 5 hours, depending on how much work I have to do and like what needs to be done. But and then from there, my daughter will probably be like, Mom, we're going to go to the mountain. So this is in the winter. Okay. And then it's like, okay, well, let's go hit the mountain. So then we'll go snowboard for a while. Then I'll come back and then we'll do chores and things that need to get done around the house or whatever. And then we go to work at gymnastics usually, and then come home. And then I paint again in the evening, usually for a couple hours. I'm not a night person. I'm a morning person. So I'd much rather wake up super early than stay up late. But yeah, I'll usually paint till like 10 and then it's the same thing the next day.
What is it you think that you're teaching your kids through all of this? I can guess, I can speculate. I've kind of referred to some things. I think you're teaching them incredible, you know, values about, you know, work and life and all these things. Mm-hmm. But what is it that you actually maybe actively as parents are like, this is what we want them to get from this whole experience, which is, you know, a bit unconventional for compared to most of society.
Yeah.
And, you know, American life anyway.
Really, I want to teach them actually to be happy. I want them to learn that life is going to throw them curveballs and there's going to be so many ups and downs, but you take from that, your personality will affect it. But emotionally, I want them to walk away knowing that they're going to choose the path that they want. And if they want to be a negative about it, then they will be. And if they want to be turn it into a positive experience, I just want them to be good people, really kind and happiness and share that with others just to bring joy into the world. So it doesn't matter what people think of you. And that's taken me a long time too. Like in high school, especially those years are really hard, you know, where you think, oh my gosh, you know, these people are going to make fun of you. They think this, but in the end, McKenna the other day was like, she's like, Mom, and even my son, he was like, you know, I just want to end up being like you. He's like, where you don't care what people think about you. I'm like, well, Tana, you know, that's taken a while. Like that's going to take a bit. And I know that you're still growing and forming who you are, but yes, in the end, you're going to, people that don't want to be around you, then they're going to walk away. And that's fine. You're not going to like everybody. And I'm a people pleaser. And so is he. So it takes a lot to have that mentality in life. But I think I'm totally, obviously I'm at the stage now where I'm like, I don't care. I mean, people know that I'm wild, crazy, loud, you know. If they don't like it, then that's, they don't choose to hang out with me.
People say when we hit 40 that you can stop caring. Like mm-hmm. that somehow there's, in that time of life, that's when you realize. And I'd have to say I'm getting closer to 50 and I'm still not there as much as I would like to be.
Yeah. I mean, life is hard, you know? I mean, truly, it is. You're trying to raise kids. You're trying to still live your life. You're trying to do things that you want. And I guess in the end, I keep thinking, like, life is short. I've been shown this, I don't know how many times, how short life is. Like, you could walk out this door and that's the end. So it's kind of like, live for now is really what I want my kids to grow up knowing that they can just live in the moment and live a happy life. Like, you don't have to do what everybody else is doing. Like, there's so many different paths for you to take. So if you're going to homeschool, unschool, go to school, like, it doesn't really matter what job you take, if you want to travel or if you want to work here and be a doctor, you know, I mean, choose what's going to make you the happiest.
Do you think they're taking to heart the live in the now, live the dream, that financial wealth is not necessarily the most important wealth mm-hmm. for them to cultivate?
I don't know. That's kind of hard to think about right now for them because they're young, but I mean, they have learned, they all have a job. They are all trying to like save money. They all kind of have some sort of a plan. But they also know, like, they know my story and they've gotten to see some of it and live through some of it. The girls obviously were much younger, but they've seen it play out because of what has happened and they've been a part of that. So I do think that they do know to like live for now, because we do talk about that quite a bit, you know.
Does your son, Montana, does he have memory of his experience with cancer and the chemo and all of that? Or is that maybe a little bit more of a story told to him because he was so young?
Yeah, when we went to St. Jude, actually, the first thing they said was, well, your son is young, so he's probably not going to remember much of this, which is a positive and a negative. And now we're seeing the negative because it's a positive because he went through a lot of traumatic stuff. It got to a point where we would drive, you know, have you been to Memphis?
Yeah.
Okay. So you know that bridge that takes you over there?
Yeah.
So when we would drive towards the end of his treatment, he was going through, because he had this horrible reaction to one of the drugs that he was on, he had to get these shots in his legs. Like every 2 weeks he would get these shots and they would burn and it was really bad. We'd have to hold him down. And so that would play. So as we would drive across this bridge, he would lose it, like start crying and screaming. And you as a parent, you're like, what do you do? You're trying to help your child, but at the same time, you don't want them to have to live through what they're doing, but you want to help them to keep living. So anyways, now he's at a point though where he doesn't remember that. So he was 2.5, 3. So he's probably 3.5 at the time when he was actually going through that part of it. And he doesn't remember it. And at the same time, like now he just said like last month, Mom, I really wish I could remember more of my treatment. But at the same time, you don't want them to remember that. But he does remember it because we would go every year. And so he would, as he got older and throughout it, he could now help give back to these kids that were there that were fighting for their own life. So he could volunteer and do different things. So he loved that part, the handing out toys. Like every year they do like a toy drive kind of thing where the kids of St. Jude and their siblings all get a toy from sponsored by Target. And so he got to help with stuff like that. So he does love to give back and that has impacted him in a positive way. But no, he doesn't remember much of the treatment and he kind of does wish he remembered some of it.
What is some advice that you have? If I circle back to when I said people probably perceive you as living this dream and how easy it must be when it's really not, you know, it's not, but you know, they see that you are living by your heart and mm-hmm. joy and family love and all those things. For those who think they can't do it, what is your advice about, you know, I really think you can.
Yeah, I know, right? Because everybody views their life so differently. Really, I would say if you want to do it, you know, then you have to be willing to take the risk. So we were willing to risk, you know, giving up our house, giving up where we were at, not putting our kids in school, You have to make the sacrifices, you know, to, because people would, I mean, when we started doing it, we decided to sell everything and hit the road. There were many people who were like, yeah, that's not going to happen. Like, you're not going to be able to make that work, you know? And I was like, oh, come hell or high water, now I'm going to make this work. Like, you don't tell me that I can't do something. That's like one of my pet peeves, you know? It's like, okay, well, now I'm going to show you that we can do this. So we just were willing to risk it all, I guess, you know, give up everything and just kind of see what was out there. And so for other people, I mean, they can do the same thing. It's just if they want to, like, do they want to take their kids out of school to make it work so you can live on the road? Do you want to work maybe a seasonal job? I mean, obviously, for some people, most of the people that we did meet on the road had a job that had to do with computers. So that made it easier for them to continue to travel because your job then is anywhere. You're working remote. Now so many people work remote that really the opportunity to do it is even easier than it was, you know, back then.
You can live with less and live more, I think is one of the ways to look at it.
Yep. Yeah. Live with less so you can live more. Yeah, for sure. You don't want to be like struggled and, just weighed down with all of your stuff. Like, you know, because in the end you can't take it with you. Right. And so that's where we have raised our kids to, and we'll tell them like, if they want to buy something, I'm like, well, do you really need that? Or you want me to take you to the Great Wolf Lodge, or you want me to take you to, you know, to Copper, or so it's like you would rather, and they're like, yeah, you're right. I'd rather go have fun and do that than buy this new sweatshirt. And I'm like, yeah, so you just got to weigh like what you want. Now, my sister, she would choose the sweatshirt. She'd be like, nope, I don't need to go, you know, hike a mountain or anything like that.
So thank you for all of this, Jess. You know, again, I think your family is inspiring and I playfully say I'm jealous, but, you know, I'm also grateful in recognizing that we get to live here together and share this sort of space. And, I look forward to also when you can show me how to surf the river.
Oh, for sure. You let me know. It'll be so good.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the We Are Chafee podcast. You can learn more about this episode and others in the show notes at wearechafeepod.com and on Instagram at wearechafeepod. I invite you to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. I also welcome your telling others about the We Are Chafee podcast. Help us to keep growing community and connection through conversation. The We Are Chafee podcast is supported by Chafee County Public Health. Thank you to Andrea Carlstrom, Director of Chafee County Public Health and Environment, and to Lisa Martin, Community Advocacy Coordinator for the larger We Are Chafee Storytelling Initiative. Once again, I'm Adam Williams, host, producer, and photographer for the We Are Chafee podcast. If you have comments, or if you know someone in Chafee County, Colorado, who I should consider talking with on the show, you can email me at adam@wearechafeepod.com. Till the next episode, as we say at We Are Chafee, share stories, make change.